Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
We are recording this broadcast. We're experiencing a little bit of rain outside, some showers. But as the old saying goes, it takes a shower to produce a flower. And we have UK's finest flower with us on this broadcast, this Dorothy Flower. Dorothy is the head of the medical life sciences team at the London, Singapore, and Hong Kong-based firm of Reynolds, Porter, and Chamberlain, RPC, as we call it. Dorothy is one of the leading medical malpractice lawyers in the UK, and Chambers has described her as a very astute and pragmatic lawyer, and that's certainly true. Takes note of her depth of experience and knowledge that she has in the medical field. And Legal 500 was even better, I think. It said, Dorothy is truly exceptional, unflappable under pressure, and a real intellectual heavyweight. And so it looks like I have my work cut out for me with you, Dorothy, but welcome. Thank you for joining us on Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio.
Oh, thank you so much, Scott, for inviting me.
Well, you have said that you watch very closely the developments in the U.S., and we certainly in the U.S. watch what the royal family is doing in the U.K., but practice and product liability area in the U.S. so important to you practicing in the U.K.?
Well, Scott, there's that old adage that I've always liked that says when America sneezes, the whole world catches a cold. And of course, that refers to economic developments, but we think it's equally applicable in the medical and life sciences arena. So we keep a very close eye on what's going on here because we want to know what is on the horizon for our clients and for us in the UK.
So is it the case usually where developments in the US work their way over to the UK, or does it work both ways?
Well, we expect it to be from the US to the UK. So a good example of that at the moment, of course, is that you are suffering the opioid crisis here. I think the few days I've been in Chicago, I haven't gone a single day without hearing something about the opioid crisis from people I've spoken to or on the television news or whatever it is. So I know it's a really big thing here. We're looking out for how that might turn out in the UK. I've got just a few claims on my desk at the moment, which are to do with opioids. So they're beginning to trickle in. I don't think it's going to be as big as it is here, but we want to know what might be coming along, and our clients definitely keep asking us about opioids.
Yeah, and the U.S., of course, just the volume of opioids and the devastation that it's caused and the drugs that continue to come through our southern border mean that we're going to be contending with this issue for a long time, notwithstanding the fact that the administration has devoted more money to this crisis than I think it's historical in terms of the effort. But on the opioid front, much of our litigation involves government entities seeking reimbursement. Would you have a similar cause? And it's a public nuisance theory under which plaintiffs pursue that. And of course, it's government entities who are looking to make up budget deficits, and that's a source of revenue for them. Yeah. Would you have similar type of litigation in the UK?
I haven't seen it on, as I said, not on the scale at the moment that you have here. And as I understand it, here in the US, the manufacturers are coming under fire, and there's some concern that prescribers of opioids will also face litigation. The sorts of claims I've seen so far on that are are smaller individual claims. I've got one at the moment where the we call them the claimant rather than the plaintiff, but where the plaintiff's lawyers haven't yet decided whether they're going to make it a medical malpractice claim against the prescriber or a product liability claim against the manufacturer. So they're still investigating, and will let us know in due course whether they're going to go after our client.
And is it an either-or choice? Could they not go after both?
They could do, but the investigation costs are so different in those two types of litigation that if it were MedMal against both defendants, that's a cost-effective thing to do. But to investigate both a product liability and a medical malpractice claim at the same time is probably not a good use of how it would work out. They want to be sure they're going to succeed against one, and the claims would be so different against those two defendants.
And we'll get into this a little bit later, but they don't have a jury to award damages in the UK, so that obviously the upside may be less in a lot of instances than it might be in the US.
Yes.
One situation that we missed out on in the U.S. that has presented some claims in the U.K. is the PIP breast implant litigation, and we missed that because the U.S. FDA did not approve that form of breast implants in our country, but it's been an issue in the U.K., and I know you've been involved in that litigation.
Yeah, that was one of the major pieces of litigation that I was involved in. I was going to say a few years ago. It's only just coming to an end now. The public attention was came to an end a little while ago, but there are always things to deal with. That was involving breast implants manufactured by a French company that then went into administration as soon as the problems arose. My client was the UK supplier of those breast implants, and there were claims by about 1,300 individuals. We don't call them class actions in the UK, but we do have what's called group litigation, which is, I think, very similar to the US class action system. That was very, got a lot of media attention, a very big piece of litigation, and it was one where significant damages were paid out by the hospitals, by the clinics, and by the insurers of all the parties involved.
And what type of implants were they? You know, here, of course, we had the silica implants.
They were silicon implants. And as you said, Scott, it's exactly right that the reason you didn't face those here was because the FDA had approved, as I understand it, a couple of different types of breast implant, and it didn't include those. The issue with those implants was that the manufacturer in France had been using a grade of silicon that wasn't good enough. Whether it was true is another matter, but the media were reporting it as being mattress-filling silicon instead of the medical-grade stuff that should have been used. And they managed to get that past the regulatory authorities that were inspecting the factory and so on. So it was something of a scandal, not just in the UK, but in France and Germany and other places as well.
So another big piece of litigation you've been involved in the UK is the metal-on-metal hip litigation. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, that's been fascinating for us as product liability lawyers, because the decision that's come out of that litigation in the UK is the most significant judgment in the product liability sphere for probably about 20 years. The metal-on-metal hips, it's a type of hip replacement prosthesis, and developed over a period of time and marketed worldwide by all the big names in manufacturing of those kind of prostheses. It was significant here against DePuy, Johnson & Johnson, and my understanding there is that billions of dollars were paid out in compensation by the manufacturers in this jurisdiction. I acted for a much smaller UK manufacturer, which did have some claims here in the US, faced a number of them. But in fact, its prostheses had been approved by the FDA under an IDE study. So it had sufficient regulatory approval to give it a really good defense to the litigation. I think he called it preemption defense.
Yes.
And so my client was able successfully to defend claims here in the US. By contrast with DePue, in the UK, things worked a little bit differently. And the defense of having regulatory approval just isn't available in quite the same way. The way it works in the UK is that that is now one of the factors that the court will take into account when deciding whether a product is defective. But the definition of defect under UK law is whether the product has the level of safety that persons generally are entitled to expect. And as you can see, that's pretty broad, and the Act of Parliament says that that has to take into account all the relevant factors. So whether a regulator has approved the product is only one of those factors, and there are many, many others as well, including, for example, the warnings that were given to any patient. And even the approval by the regulator was not part of what the court could take into account under a previous judgment of the court. So it was pretty groundbreaking in May of last year when a judgment came out in the DePue part of the metal on metal hips litigation that allowed that to be taken into account. And so those claims were successfully defended in the UK, and Johnson & Johnson got a significant win there. My client, for different reasons, had to bring the litigation to an end a little bit earlier.
And so it's probably worth stepping back a little bit and talking about the theories of recovery in a product liability case in the UK. I understand it could be statutory, it could be negligence, but can you just walk us through the alternative theories and the elements yes. that a claimant is required to prove?
Yes. If a claimant wants to bring a product liability claim, the obvious route is through our consumer protection legislation, and that derives from an EU regulation, an EU directive, which was implemented back in 1987 in the UK through the Consumer Protection Act.
Just one quick question before you continue on. Was that passed by Parliament so that it would survive Brexit, as it were, or is that at risk of is Brexit at risk of changing the law? And as we speak today, we just received word that there's been another extension of that deadline.
So far as many of us are concerned, Scott, Brexit is a swear word. We're trying
to. And I've been known to use those even on this program, but they get edited out. So I guess maybe we're bleeping Brexit.
It was passed by the UK government way back then, because that's how EU legislation has to be implemented by all of the EU member states. So that was the UK's way of implementing that directive through that Act of Parliament. And in fact, because it is an Act of Parliament, it survives whatever happens to Brexit. Or with Brexit, and so it will continue to have force in the UK. So there could well be changes, because now we're not if we leave the EU, we won't be bound to comply with those directives in the future. But as we speak today, things are still pretty uncertain.
Yeah. So before I interrupted you with cursing, you were about to describe the theories and recovery under the Consumer Act.
Yeah, well, I've already said that under the consumer protection legislation, that's strict liability, and if a product is defective under the definition that I mentioned earlier, then the claimant can be compensated whether or not the manufacturer did anything wrong, whether there's any fault at all. So there's a lot to take into account. There are various requirements that have to be fulfilled under the Act, but that's the essence of it. But a consumer doesn't have to use that Act, a plaintiff doesn't have to use that Act. A claim can be brought in negligence, and that would be exactly the same standard of negligence as in any negligence action, which is the requirement to prove, first of all, that there was a duty of care, then there was a breach of that duty of care, and then that that breach of duty caused, in this case, some injury. And those are the three elements of a negligence action in whatever area we're talking about. So that applies equally to malpractice.
Yes. So what would advantages or disadvantages to a claimant be in asserting a claim under the statute or negligence? Obviously, not having to prove negligence, but does the statute provide for any defenses that wouldn't be available at common law for malpractice or for negligence?
It's very much the choice of the plaintiff as to which they use. It would make no difference to the damages that they're awarded. Defenses, it does make a difference, because you can immediately see from the way those two actions are structured that with a negligence action, there is the necessity to prove fault. So that's why I say that the obvious route for a plaintiff would be to go under the Consumer Protection Act, because there's no requirement to prove fault. But if there's a very obvious fault that the plaintiff can demonstrate, then using the tort of negligence might be a useful way to proceed. I probably should mention as well that there is also the option to bring an action in contract, in breach of contract, so that I spoke earlier about the PIP breast implants litigation. And in that litigation, because my client was the supplier, it didn't have any direct contact with the individuals who had had those implants. So they mostly sued the hospitals and the clinics where the implants had been implanted. And it was the hospitals and the clinics which then brought what we call an additional claim, or Part 20 proceedings. That's a procedural term. Against my clients, and that was brought in contract. So that was brought under the Supply of Goods and Services Act, and then the Sale of Goods Act against my client. So there are various routes that product liability claims can take in the UK.
Now, you had mentioned earlier that preemption, for example, is an element to be considered by the court. How is that considered? Is that considered as whether there's a breach of duty, or is it considered as a defense?
It works as a part of the defense, and we don't call it preemption. The Consumer Protection Act says that all relevant factors have to be taken into account in establishing whether or not a product is defective, and it lists a certain number of potential factors to be taken into account. The way it was used, the way we raised it in the metal on metal hips litigation, and the way that the court decided that it was applicable, was to say that if a regulator has decided that this product is safe, sufficiently safe to go on the market, and if the regulator continues to say that the product is safe, hasn't suggested that the product be withdrawn, then that must be something that influences the public expectation of safety, which is the definition of defect.
And one of the big causes of action for products liability in the United States is the failure to warn theory. Does that come into play at all in the UK?
Very much so. That's very much one of the factors that is listed in the Consumer Protection Act, so that part of the evidence that we would need to put together for defense of a product liability claim would be to locate the patient information leaflets that were with the product at the time, instructions for use of any product, so what was given to surgeons or to prescribers, and as I say, the patient information leaflet that would be with a drug or with the product itself. Very important what the contents of those warnings would be.
Let's shift gears a little bit, because one of the other areas that you are very well versed in is medical malpractice. And you recently had a medical malpractice claim against your client who is a primary care physician. Could you talk to us a little bit about that case and medical malpractice in general?
Yeah, the medical malpractice side of my practice is quite a significant part, a very fascinating one. So just in, I'll come in a moment to the primary care physician, but it's probably worth mentioning that we've dealt recently with one of the biggest pieces of malpractice litigation in the UK in recent years that came to an end a year or so ago, when there was an individual doctor, surgeon, mostly breast surgery, but doing other things as well, who was found to have been involved in what turned out to be criminal activity in his cavalier way of treating his patients, mostly women who had breast cancer. And he's actually serving a fairly lengthy term in prison as we speak, at Her Majesty's pleasure. He had been practicing...
When you say at Her Majesty's pleasure, does that mean for as long as she likes?
It's how we describe it when people go to jail for quite a long time. He's doing 20 years for his malpractice, effectively, for the criminal activity that he was engaged in. I acted for a hospital, the private hospital in which he practiced, and there were about 800 individuals who sued him and my client hospital and our public NHS system, the National Health Service, for his nefarious practice.
Could you describe that a little bit? Because I imagine it takes more than negligence or even gross negligence to amount to criminal conduct.
Yes. There were various elements to his practice which were simply unacceptable. But one of them was, for example, a procedure that he called the cleavage-sparing mastectomy. So it was women with breast cancer for whom the appropriate surgery would have been a complete mastectomy, removal of the breast. And he would perform surgery that involved leaving sufficient breast tissue behind to give a better aesthetic result following reconstruction surgery. But of course, if you leave breast tissue behind, there's a very good chance you leave cancerous tissue behind. And that was what was happening. So there were women who had a recurrence of cancer that they wouldn't otherwise have had, and some even who possibly didn't survive that. There were lots of instances, really on the other side of the coin, where he would perform surgery that wasn't required at all, including some individuals who underwent multiple unnecessary procedures over a period of time. And of course, because my client was the private hospital group, these were paying patients, paying either on their own account or by their insurer. So he did stand to gain additional income by carrying out unnecessary surgery. So that was one element to it as well. Those are just some examples of some of what he was doing.
I don't want to get political, but I do want to ask you a little bit, because healthcare is a major issue in the United States, and an issue of whether we private versus public versus Medicare for all. What is generally, how does the healthcare situation work in the UK, and the difference between when somebody goes for private paying care in terms of waiting time and availability of procedures?
That is political. It's a big controversial subject in the UK, as you can imagine. We have a fantastic public healthcare system. I think it's sort of widely accepted that the care that is available in the NHS is probably second to none in the world. And for patients who are in the most serious trouble with the most serious conditions, they won't get better care than in the NHS. But it is a huge, huge, huge organisation. I think it's the biggest employer in the world. And there are always going to be things going wrong in that sort of organisation. And there is a huge budget that the NHS has for because of the claims that it has to pay out on. I don't do any work for the NHS. All my practice is for the private healthcare sector. So far as waiting times are concerned, I think you asked about waiting times. There is an issue about waiting times in the NHS for routine surgery. There have in the past been targets, and there are arguments about whether it's a good idea to have a target for somebody to be treated within a certain period of time. Sometimes that's counterproductive because it means that somebody else who perhaps should be treated sooner doesn't get the treatment when they should because somebody else is coming to the end of the target waiting time. So it is a difficult problem. Individuals have the choice as to whether they are treated instead in the private sector. But of course, for that, you need either private healthcare insurance or personal resources.
One of the key differences between the legal systems in the U.S. and the U.K. is, of course, our famous or infamous jury system here, which we could talk about the merits or demerits of it, but no jury in the U.K.
No, not in civil litigation. We still have juries in for criminal proceedings, but in the area in which I practice, in civil litigation, we don't have juries, so any first instance decision is by a single judge, and a judge is not elected but appointed by the Judicial Appointments Commission and will have been a practicing lawyer before becoming a judge. So they tend to be very senior lawyers who then actually probably take a pay cut in order to go to the bench.
That's how it usually works here as well. And in the UK, no punitive or exemplary damages.
No.
Except in some very rare circumstances.
Yeah, very, very rare indeed. The I think that's why there's such a big difference between the level of damages awards in the UK from those that you'd get for a similar sort of case here in the US. Because the way in which damages are decided in the UK is subject to very strict rules, and it's based on legal precedent and actual financial loss for which there has to be evidence. So that the obviously claimants will try to maximise the damages they can recover, and defendants will seek to undermine that evidence, but generally speaking, there is something of a consensus as to what the appropriate level of damages should be. So in my area of law, where we're talking about injury claims, for an individual case, an award that was in the multi-millions, say 10, 15, 20 million, that would be considered to be a substantial case. But I think that's probably pretty routine here. You don't have a jury which reacts in an emotional way to the injury that has been suffered and want to punish the defendant in some way. There isn't that opportunity. So we don't get the tens, even hundreds of millions of pounds worth of awards.
So elements such as lost wages and medical expenses would be recoverable.
Yes, yeah.
What about things like pain and suffering?
Yeah, pain and suffering, we sometimes call that general damages. That's one part of the damages award. And it's that aspect of the decision, the award, that is subject to legal precedent. And we have a little book the Judicial College guidelines, which has categories of injury and the sorts of awards for pain and suffering that would be applicable. And the court is very strongly governed by those guidelines. And then, as you say, the other part of the award, the financial loss, for things like lost earnings, for future care, treatment, past care, any other therapies, we call it physiotherapy, I think you call it physical therapy, is that
yes.
right? Yeah.
Yes.
So really anything that, oh, and sometimes if in the sad cases where the plaintiff has a brain injury and isn't able to manage their own finances, and there will be a very significant financial award, there will be part of the award will be for the managing of that fund of money.
And is the award a final award, or is there an opportunity for a claimant to open it up after a period of time if, let's say, the injuries or the damages turn out to be greater than what was contemplated at the time of the initial trial?
It's very rare for it to be possible to open it up later, but the way in which that sort of contingency tends to be dealt with is it's possible to have a lump sum award at the time of the conclusion of the case, and then that's a large sum of money for the potentially for the claimant or the claimant's representatives to manage. But what we're increasingly seeing in the UK, and I think you have it here as well, is a situation where there might be a smaller lump sum award immediately, and then, for example,
periodic
annual
payments.
Exactly,
yeah.
PPAs.
Yeah. We do that commonly in a structured settlement
yeah.
situation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, otherwise you would, you know, it would normally be a one-time award. Maybe it's discounted
yeah,
present
yeah,
value.
Yeah, yeah. We have exactly that. And, of course, it's not something that's very attractive to insurers. They would always rather have the lump sum so that it's off their books now. It can work out to be a lower reward in the longer term if the plaintiff turns out to have a lower life expectancy than was anticipated. But otherwise, it can be a drain for a long time.
Let's just get some of your insights on the type of regulation relevant to your practice in the UK and how it impacts defending cases.
Yeah, that's a very broad question because my practice is pretty broad, and of course there's regulation in every part of life, let alone every part of the law.
But maybe just a couple of examples.
I'll do that. We've already spoken about regulation of products, and our main regulator in the UK is the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, and that body regulates not just medical devices but also pharmaceuticals, and there are lots of rules around that, all of which derive from European Union law, so that's pretty interesting. When it comes to the malpractice side and the hospital side, we have something called the CQC, the Care Quality Commission, that regulates hospitals. And of course, individual practitioners are regulated by specific bodies for them. So we have the General Medical Council for doctors, the General Dental Council for dentists, the Health and Care Professions Council for lots of other practitioners. And those bodies will investigate the fitness to practice of individual practitioners, and we get involved in defending those practitioners before.
When their licenses essentially are on the line.
Yes, precisely. And you can imagine there's a high level of emotion attached to dealing with those cases.
And another type of case that you deal with are claims arising out of clinical trials.
I do, yeah. Those are very interesting because it's a whole different regime. So insurers will have clinical trials policies, which can be on the basis that they insure an organization. So, for example, it could be the manufacturer of the product, whether it's the pharma product or the device, or the clinical research organization can have in clinical trials cover, or indeed there can be a policy that covers a particular trial if that's going to last a few years, and the policy will cover for the lifetime of the trial. And what is really interesting about dealing with those claims is that they are, again, no fault. And it's different from strict liability. It's in a clinical trials scenario, it's a question of whether the participation in the trial caused the injury, regardless of whether or not there's no need at all to show that there was any mistake, any negligence, any error in the performance of the trial, any problem with the, say, the drug that was being tested. That's all irrelevant. The only thing is whether or not that individual, the trial subject, would have suffered that injury if they had not taken part in the trial.
Well, I wanted to just get your thoughts and observations and what you see are some of the trends and things looking down the road for your practice.
Well, one of the most significant, which I'm sure is equally on your radar here, is to do with artificial intelligence, technology, and so on. And that's of particular interest to me and my practice, because it illustrates the crossover between medical malpractice and product liability. So we're seeing, beginning to see situations where, for example, robotics are used to assist with surgery. If something goes wrong there, is that the negligence of the surgeon who has chosen to use that particular assistance, or maybe the surgeon's own management of the technology, or will the liability lie with the software manufacturer or the hardware manufacturer? So we're going to be very interested to see how those sorts of claims pan out in the future. Also, I suppose slightly linked to that, increasing use of remote care and treatment, whether that's by telemedicine or by internet prescribing, or you can think of the various ways in which suddenly there's no need to be in the same office as the physician.
And, you know, people, traditionalists, look and say, well, how can a doctor prescribe or treat somebody remotely? But there are a lot of advantages apart from cost savings. I mean, you're not subjecting people to germs and communicable diseases. You're able to do things on a quicker basis, which a lot of times results in better treatment.
Yeah, and just the convenience of not having to travel. Presumably, you could just take 5 minutes out of the workplace to have the consultation instead of having to take a day at home and go and see your physician that way. So all sorts of advantages.
How does the UK law deal with comparative or contributory negligence of the claimant and the relative liability of various defendants?
We do have the opportunity when defending claims to suggest that the plaintiff was contributory negligent. It's not always very attractive because when you have an individual who's been injured in some way, to say, okay, yeah, we made mistakes, but the patient also made mistakes, doesn't always go down very well. But it's certainly a defense that we use selectively, and in the right case, we will definitely argue that the claimant could have done something a bit differently and then wouldn't have suffered those consequences. Similarly, with co-defendants, it's very often the case in my practice that you will have a number of defendants who are involved, and that can be the private hospital or clinic, the individual practitioner, and that works because very often the physician, the doctor, the surgeon is not employed by the private hospital, and so will carry liability separately from the hospital. And then sometimes, if the patient has also been treated in the National Health Service, you would have the NHS Trust as another defendant. So it always becomes a very interesting carve-up. whether it's on an individual basis or in the very big litigation I described with the breast surgeon.
If the trust is a defendant, are there any caps or limitations or other obstacles to recovery that a claimant would face as opposed to a private party?
Absolutely none. The rules are exactly the same, and the measure of damages, the way in which the claim will be pursued and defended, will be exactly the same.
Well, I want to, you've been awfully generous with your time, but I want to, and I think you'll indulge me on the final subject, which is a very interesting theory that I had seen you talk about on a video on the internet called nocebo.
This is one of my favorite subjects, Scott, so I'm delighted to have a chance to say something about it. The nocebo theory is something that, obviously not my area of expertise, it's something that behavioral psychologists have been talking about increasingly over recent years. And if you Google nocebo, you'll find some very interesting articles, interesting stories, and so on about how it works. Essentially what it is, it has been called the sibling, I think even the dastardly sibling, of placebo. So we all know what a placebo is. It's when you're told to take this pill and that's going to help, that's going to make you better, and so you take the pill and you feel better. And that works even if the pill that you take has no therapeutic benefit whatsoever, effectively a sugar pill. And nocebo works in the opposite way. So there's a lot of evidence to demonstrate, for example, that if you're given a drug to take and you're told that there are these potential side effects of the drug, there's a strong likelihood that you'll suffer those side effects, not just because they are the side effects of the drug, but because you've been told about them. And there are some studies, for example, that show that if you have a cohort of people in several groups, and one, you don't mention any side effects, and another group, you tell them about some side effects, but not all of them, and the other one, you give them the whole story in the most graphic detail. The ones who suffer the worst side effects, of course, the ones who get the graphic detail. So some very, very interesting evidence about that. We came across that when we were investigating for the purpose of the defense of the metal-on-metal hits litigation. And why it was of particular interest to us was because the media in the UK were very interested in the whole hip story. So when metal-on-metal was first on the market, it was called the Wonder Hip. It was highly promoted. This was going to be life-changing for everybody who needed a hip replacement. And so, of course, people were queuing up to get this particular type of prosthesis, and even those who were told that it was really intended for younger, very active people, they saw themselves as younger and active, and they wanted this type of hip. So, but then it started to be clear that there were some individuals who were suffering some difficulty with the hip, and when the media got hold of that, suddenly it became the killer hip. And there were some noticeable points in the history of the product where there would be television programs, documentary programs, or newspaper reports about the potential for problems associated with metal on metal. And we were staggered looking at the 300 or whatever it was individuals who were suing our clients in that litigation, the number of them where we could pinpoint their first noticing symptoms or problems absolutely related to those media reports. So we included the nocebo effect as part of our defense of that litigation. And I'm very happy to say that when the judge gave judgment in the related Depew action, that was taken into account as one of the factors of some significance.
It's very interesting. And how does it operate, though, in the courtroom setting? In other words, so the theory makes sense to me, because if our wonderful producer at told me he had just given me, put something in my drink that would kill me in half an hour. Our listeners would be able to listen to me die during the course of the broadcast.
Oh, no, Scott, no.
But how can you differentiate if you've got, let's say, a particular drug that has side effects and it's side effect A, whether it was the drug that actually caused it or the nocebo effect that caused it?
Yeah. Of course, we had to have expert evidence. So we got a very lengthy report from a behavioral psychology expert who had written fairly extensively about the nocebo effect. As part of his production of his report, he got a number of colleagues to do a full study identifying other studies. So it was a meta-analysis of all the studies that had been done on nocebo in order to put the evidence together that he needed in order to illustrate the point in his report. But then it was really going to be on a case-by-case basis, and the way that group actions work in the litigation, we couldn't have a situation where everybody where there was a potential nocebo effect defense could be analyzed. So what we did was just to use it in the context of one, maybe two the claimants whose cases were the illustrative cases for the purpose of the action.
Did you have to put in any evidence that it was not a physical side effect?
Well, it is a, that's the what's so interesting
caused
about it.
Caused by the, you know, the device or the drug.
Yeah. Well, it's the nocebo effect often works by producing things that are fairly subjective. So if you say you're in pain, I can't tell whether you're in pain or not. But if you're genuinely feeling the pain, that's pain. But there are lots of things like that are the result of the nocebo effect. So pain, tingling, it tends to be, so it's not something that would be very obvious and so on. Not necessarily something that could be identified by the physician. Then, of course, if you do further tests on the individual, you might find that there are things that aren't right, but those might not have been the things that caused the symptoms. So that's where the nocebo effect comes in. It's not a quite difficult thing to explain, to identify, and to use in evidence. But it was only a very small part of the judgment. But we were very pleased to see that the judge had some reliance on it.
It's fascinating listening to you talk about it, I have to say. Well, Dorothy, thank you so much for joining us on Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio. Very interesting discussion, interesting to learn about some of the differences and similarities between the U.S. and the U.K. and malpractice and medical device litigation. Dorothy Flower, head of RPC's Medical Life Sciences team, has been our guest. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, to let us know if you have any suggestions regarding guests or topics of interest to insurers or reinsurance professionals or counsel for future broadcasts. This is Scott Seaman thanking you for joining us. We look forward to presenting the next episode of Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Royal, take us home.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.